Thelema, Coast to Coast, Show 34, September 24th, 2006. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of the show. Before getting into the show, I want to remind listeners that there are four ways to contact the podcast. First is via email at podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com, the website www.thelemacoasttocoast.com, voicemail at 206-600-4216, and via the regular mail, Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, M-A-R-I-E-T-T-A, 30065 in the United States. Also, I want to remind listeners that there is a Thelema Coast to Coast MySpace page. There's currently over 900 people friended on that, and that's a great way to know when new shows come out because I post a bulletin and blog post about it. So that can be found at www.myspace.com/ThelemaCoastToCoast. And also there is a Frapper map with the locations of many, many of the Thelema Coast to Coast podcast listeners, hundreds in fact. I think we have listeners now on all the continents except Antarctica. So I think that's pretty cool. And if you want to be on that list, go to the Thelema Coast to Coast website and click on the Frapper map that's on the bottom of the front page and add yourself. I love taking a look and seeing where all the listeners are from and all the messages they put out there. So I really encourage people to go do that. All right, I want to get into some of the feedback. Received a lot of messages, and I'm going to be reading a few. First is from a listener who calls himself Lux15. He said, John, I enjoyed the paper and discussion you delivered in Podcast 33. Would you consider posting online the paper itself? Reading it instead of hearing it would give me a chance to mull it over in a different fashion. Your work is much appreciated. Thanks. In a short answer, it is no. I will not be posting the paper online. That was actually given at a conference in April of 2006, and the selected proceedings of that will be published by Luxor Press. So that should be coming out by the end of the year. And when that does come out, if you are interested in getting a copy of the paper, I'll let you all know how to get a hold of that book. And so you can purchase that and get a copy of the lecture. So unfortunately, because it's being published, I can't put it out on the web. But that will be out in print form if you want to get it by the end of the year. So thanks for emailing, and I'm glad you like the show. And again, that will be out by the end of the year. The next email is from a listener named Jim. Jim writes, thank you once again for stressing the importance of the Buddhism part of the 0 = 2 equation. I'm a Thelemite from Ann Arbor, Michigan. I've been studying Tibetan Buddhism for quite some time now and have a hard time expressing Buddhist concepts to my fellow Thelemites. Listening to your podcast has helped me to formulate some ideas on how to present these topics. Your discussions with Keith 418 have been a real inspiration to us. Keep up the good work. It's much appreciated. Jim. Well, Jim, I'm glad you like the lecture that I gave. The Buddhism aspect is... I really didn't go into it. It's from, in my opinion, the Mahayana ideas of Madhyamaka. So I would recommend if you wanted to pick up some of the vocabulary and talk about this with fellow Thelemites, to read some books from Nagarjuna. And in particular, there's a book by Garfield, J. Garfield. And that is really a great book to kind of get into the ideas. Also, reading some of the ideas about Mahayana and Theravada philosophy will help give you some of the vocabulary so you can articulate a lot of these things. Ultimately, it takes reading and engaging into the material to get the ideas about what this is, as well as gaining the vocabulary to really articulate these ideas. So I would encourage you to read a broad spectrum of books about that, and don't skimp on the scholarly books, because they're the ones who really go in and differentiate things and really expand the vocabulary. And struggle with the Sanskrit and Pali. It's difficult, and in your case, since you're studying Vajrayana, also the Tibetan, it really makes a difference to learn those things and understand those concepts. So thanks again for writing, Jim. The last email is from a listener who calls himself Psyche. He writes, I enjoyed your latest podcast immensely, and the previous one with Keith 418. I've listened to most of your podcasts, but these two stood out more for their sheer volume of content. I hope these lectures will become a regular feature going forward, though not the dominant content, as that could easily become overwhelming, both for yourselves and for your listeners. One notable difference was that you managed to say interesting a few hundred times fewer than usual. You really must find a thesaurus. There are a plethora of words available that can communicate a sense of wonder better than this rather bland and tired word. Best of luck in future shows. Well, thanks for the feedback, Psyche. I found it very interesting. No, I understand that that is a word that I say often. And in listening to the interviews in this podcast, you'll find that many of the interviewees were also saying interesting frequently. So what I suggest, instead of banning the word interesting or going out and getting a thesaurus and flexing our vocabulary that way and start saying curious and fascinating and many other words that express wonderment, as you said, instead, I think we should start the Thelema Coast to Coast drinking game. And with that, what you can do is grab your friends and listen to the podcast together or drink by yourself. And grab some beer or some wine, some alcohol. And every time I or one of the guests say, interesting, take a drink. By the end of the show, you'll have heard a very interesting podcast, as well as be feeling very, very interesting. So, but thanks for the feedback, Psyche. I appreciate that. And I'll do what I can about diminishing the word interesting in what I say. But not completely, because I wouldn't want to deprive all my listeners of some words to drink by. There, I also received feedback from Darren, Trent, Justine, and her husband, a different Jim, and Brian. So thank you all for sending the feedback, and I really, really like receiving feedback. Hint, hint. So send it in via email, the website, or in particular, call the voicemail at 206-600-4216. I also received an email from a Dane. He asked me to mention a new pagan website. I know we have a number of pagan listeners. It's called The Pagan Activist. It's kind of an online pagan newspaper that has articles and forums that can be reached at www.thepaganactivist.com. So go check that out. All right, our guests. We have three on today's show. The first guest is Christian Fitzharris, aka Scholar. I've played him a few times on the show. He is a rapper who incorporates Thelemic and occult material into his songs. And so I will be playing a song of his after the interview. And then also I will be playing a song of his at the end of the show. Then after Christian, we have an interview with Keith 418. He and I discuss cults and the appearance of being cultic and the responses that people have to that in the Thelemic community, as well as occultism in general. And then the last interview is with an academic named Gordon Jurjevich, and we'll be discussing Indian Tantra and its place in Western occultism, especially related to Crowley. And since there's a lot on this show, let's get right into it. So here is the interview with Christian Fitzharris.
We have on the phone with us Christian Fitzharris. Are you there, Christian?
I am here, John. Thank you.
Welcome to the podcast, 93.
And it's great to be here.
Now, some people know you by your artist name, Scholar, and we've played a number of your songs on the podcast before. Your genre is rap, which is kind of unique in some of the occult circles. We see a lot of either kind of acoustic or electronic and maybe even some heavy metal or death metal like what was played recently. But as far as I'm aware, you're the only rapper who's incorporating esoteric, thelemic material in their repertoire. How did you get into music and incorporating Thelema into rap?
I've always been a huge fan of hip-hop, the hip-hop Muppet generation, if you will, being 32 years old. So I always had a deep love for hip-hop, but I also was influenced by other, you know, that's why you hear such an eclectic sound, and that ranges in everything you just said. It's because I've always had a wide influence, and I kind of pull them together. So I've always loved hip-hop, and I've always loved ceremonial magic, and Thelema specifically, being introduced to Crowley at the age of 17, and then practicing ceremonial magic for 12 years now. It just seemed like a simple marriage that would be real fun to put together. And for me, it seemed normal. I started doing this in approximately 1998. I made a CD. I started to record a CD that had Golden Dawn references because I was following that path at that time for those few years. So I was rapping about Golden Dawn stuff, throwing in a little Crowley for good measure, like a big gumbo pot. And everything started to come, but then people said they didn't really understand what I was talking about. So I would rap a song, and instead of someone going, "Hey, that's really, you know, great song, I can dance to it," instead, they went, "Well, that's cool, but I don't understand what you're talking about, because I don't study ceremonial magic or any of this other stuff." So I almost gave up, and then I heard another rapper out there named Cool Keith, who raps about just kind of like anything. He's like an eccentric guy who raps about, like, aliens and alligators that talk and Shakespeare coming back from the dead and stuff. And I started to realize that if you're weird, you know, you could be weird and say nothing and people still enjoy it. So I could at least say something that means something to a small amount of people and hit that demographic.
Okay.
And hopefully I bring it with a, you know, a kind of a hip-hop flow, and it's catchy, you know? The kids like singing, you know, like, "Do what thou wilt, shall be the whole of the law," and stuff like that. It's catchy, and sometimes can follow you into the shower.
All right. Now, what kind of response has there been to your recent material from non-esoteric people? Have they liked the music, liked the rhymes, and kind of asked about what the things mean and have been drawn into the ideas that you present?
Yeah, that's what is actually most surprising, because I was only doing this, number one, I was doing this for myself, and then I started to, you know, hang out with, whether they're members of the OTO, whether they're practicing Thelemites or ceremonial magicians, they go, "Hey, there's finally someone I can relate to." So that seemed cool, because I actually had an audience I was performing for other than me, and people going, "That's neat." But the weird thing has been the transfer over to people who don't have any of this background, and all of a sudden, like on my MySpace page, which we'll talk about later, but it was really funny to go to people's sites and click on their site, and like they have, I know them, you know, I've met these people a bunch of times, and they're just like normal, you know, plumbers or engineers or, you know, mechanics, and then they have the most overt Thelemic ceremonial magic song on their page taken from one of my things.
Mm-hmm.
And that started to become kind of peculiar, because you'd look at this person, I knew them from talking with them, and I knew they had nothing to do with anything, you know, so-called metaphysical or occult, and now they've been attracted to such heavy, you know, you can even choose, I have a span of music, so you can choose a more mainstream hip-hoppy thing where there's just a few references, or you can choose something overtly Thelemic or ceremonial, but it was very funny to see these people really reacting well. And I play live shows here in Las Vegas, and I've played everywhere from jazz clubs to the Burning Man regional arts events to my favorite. I played one hip-hop club. That was a good one. That was a tentative time, but, you know, but they really enjoyed it. And then I played my favorite one, which I mentioned in the song LJ, biker bars. I played a biker bar, and it was
really?
The best, because it was totally, I was going in there, it was supposed to be like an artsy night, and it was like, yeah, this is going to be the next artsy scene, and it wasn't an artsy scene. It was just a biker bar in downtown, in the downtown area. It was rough. It had swinging doors and that sort of thing. And I came in like a tie, ready to do metaphysical hip-hop for people that are screaming at the DJ to play something they've heard.
And what was the response from them to your music?
Well, after I figured out who the alpha males in the room were and realized that I had to, I walked over to them because they were eyeing me like they were going to, you know, beat me up or something. I walked directly over to them and I said, ordered a shot and a beer and said, "Hey, what's going on? And they go, nothing. What are you here for? I said, well, I'm going to do some metaphysical hip-hop. And they go, that doesn't sound good. And I said, well, it could be good, it could be bad. I don't know. It should be just, it doesn't have to be, you know, horrible just because something's different. But all I know is, if anything's thrown at me, I'm throwing it right back. And the guy goes, well, I'm not throwing anything until I'm done drinking it. So I performed, and people actually, it was great. So they were quiet. Then there was an insurgence of people getting angry and actually screaming, and I just ignored them. I started videotaping just to be more annoying. And then at the end, it was great because those same guys at the beginning, after I did about a half hour's worth of material, much to their chagrin, poor people, the guys that had... So, who I talked to at the beginning came over, and they go, we don't know what the heck you were saying up there, but you got some real cojones doing it in here. Let's buy you a beer.
All right.
So it's a wide audience, and what I'm finding is it's wider than I'd done this kind of for me as an outlet, and I'm finding that it's a huge audience, and it's not just limited to esoteric material, and I am getting people's responses are, you know, what's this, or you talk about this, or recommend a book. And I'm sure you've experienced some of this being public with the Lima podcast. You start getting emails from people, you know, wanting you to, you know, explain things or do things.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite, you know, ones have been, like, emails explaining, you know, the Staley of Revealing and stuff, where they could find one, or like, just practical things. Like, they don't say, hey, I like your music. They say, you're a resource. We
right.
seem to be pretty loud about it, so... And again, the demographic is pretty huge. I have, you know, people in the older generation, 60 to 70 years old, who didn't catch the hip-hop vibe when it was being distributed. And they're just the same. They're going, wow, that's actually smart, because also rap has a stereotype attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of my influences have come from, you know, going outside of the stereotype, more politically minded, or saying something different, whether it's creative or, you know, antagonizing. I had also done an adaptation of, I was approached by a contact in New York to do an adaptation of Titus Andronicus, a musical section from Titus Andronicus. And they said, you know, they'd met a friend of mine and said, I'm looking for someone to translate Shakespeare into hip-hop.
Now,
do you know anyone?
Very interesting.
And my friend said, actually, I think I do know someone who could do that. And they called me and said, would you be interested in taking this one scene between the goth boys and whatnot, where they attack this woman, or they talk about attacking this woman, mm-hmm. and they said they wanted it to be an aggressive kind of Beastie Boys-ish.
Yeah, I know the scene.
Hip-hop scene. So I adapted that, and I went, I think I can. Yeah, why couldn't I? One of my gigs here doing my metaphysical stuff is taking the Book of the Law or Magic and Theory and Practice and cramming it in there. So I went to the library, got a dictionary of just Shakespearean words and insults, Shakespearean insults. And from that, I created this piece that was played off Broadway. So there's a varied response, and it's coming from all angles, and it's actually exciting because I didn't anticipate any of this, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think the Thelemic material brings to it? You said that there's a stereotype about rap, and often you hear rappers just saying that they're the best, or they're rapping about, you know, their cars or their clothes or the girls or stuff like that. What does the Thelemic material bring to it that makes it unique?
Number one, if I'm referencing, say, Crowley from Magic and Theory and Practice, he was educated. Some would say snobbishly so, but that's what I like about him. All of the stuff is, Thelema is very artistic, and every time I watch a Gnostic Mass, and then if I'm not concentrating on what's actually happening, and I realize, and just watch it, the Gnostic Mass is a beautiful, artistic ritual,
mm-hmm.
the way you see it. And people take it for granted or whatever, it's too much, you know, some people would say it's too much like an Orthodox thing, but it's not. It has, the way he had written it, and, you know, ever turning about thee with annual and diurnal motion, that whole thing.
Right.
There is artistry, because Crowley was not only intelligent, educated, but he was an artist. And so it can't help but seep through all of Thelema, and then thereby, if I inject it into hip-hop or mix the two together, it's kind of like the beat makes you hungry for something, and then the intellectual material actually gives you a meal.
Okay. Well, let's talk about your production company. What's the name of it?
St- Star 156 Productions.
And when did that get created?
We created it this year, towards the beginning of this year. And basically, it was made as a promotional vehicle to take not only, myself as, if we're going to call me a band, you know.
Okay.
After all, Nine Inch Nails is one guy for the most part. So.
Right.
If we're going to call me a band, we're going to take a bunch of different bands that have different things to say and put them together. Now, it could be, or they could just be a good band. It depends. You just have to judge it on a case-by-case basis because, as I've learned, if you're too eclectic, some people don't want you, but others do. You just have to find where it's going to work. So the company was formed by myself and two other Thelemites, and we formed it so that we could promote music and art. One of the other founders of the company is heavily involved in the art scene here in Las Vegas, and the band, and he's a DJ as well, and very versatile and intelligent, and he has a real finger on the pulse of what's going on artistically within the community. So it's also kind of cool because we've got him out there doing this stuff, right? We've got myself, who's just kind of working in, and also artist in residence of sorts, and then we have the president of the company, who's the overall, you know, business super mind that kind of brings the art and the eccentric music together in a fully marketable, packageable experience that takes Salima out into the real world. And obviously it's Salimic, Star 156. Yeah, try explaining that on your business card when you're at general meeting. Now, what's this occult symbol?
Right.
So, you know, it's not going to be for everyone. But again, Salima's, as I say in LJ, which I seem to be quoting a lot now, but Salima's really about just, you know, hitting the creative beach like a storm of troops, just like doing your true will. And it doesn't have to be, it can be anything you want it to be, but if on a Thelemic path, we should start looking more towards globalizing Thelema as opposed to, specializing or writing little things here and there, which do contribute. But overall, I think it was one of your earlier podcasts last year or so that Keith was talking about producing material and books. And an outflow of books and constantly creating and doing something different and not copying the same thing Crowley's done for a long time. And I think that that's really important to look at on a global Thelemic scale, you know?
Well, speaking of production, though, where's your CD? When's that coming out?
My CD is coming out December. We haven't set the exact date yet. We know it's going to be towards the end of December. So it's great for the holidays and the new year. What a way to start your new year with your Thelemic Hip Hop CD, which is tentatively titled at this point, Diary of a Dope MC. I chose that instead of the other idea of Raptism of Fire.
Yeah, so, I think the first one's better.
Yeah.
Well, if people want to hear some of your music, where can they find you on the web?
We will have a website connected to it, which is being constructed now, but my mode of choice is www.myspace.com/scholar, or backslash, I guess it's called.
Right.
Scholar.
All right, and I'll have a link to that on the show notes.
Beautiful.
And you have a few songs up there right now?
I do. I have three songs.
Okay.
They will probably be changed out. The first one is more of a mainstream thing, but still, even in my what I would call my mainstream songs, it still goes a little too far over, you know, who's Dionysus, and why do you keep mentioning him, you know? Stuff like that, but it has a mainstream song and I think two metaphysical songs. And the CD will be packaged so that it's a mixture, but there will also be a version available for those who are just interested in Thelema and ceremonial magic so that you don't necessarily have to, you know, if you want to specialize, we're going to have multiple copies available for this, reaching the people's specific needs, John.
All right. Well, that sounds good, Christian. So you'll have to let me know when that CD comes out so I can let people be aware of that so they can go and get it.
That sounds sweet.
Well, we need to wrap things up. So
that's precious.
I will have a link to that, and I will be playing an outgoing song of yours called 93. And I appreciate you being on the podcast, 93.
Thank you, John, 93.
You are the real chubby, the whole of the law. Raw work, we seated in the east underneath. No law beyond, do what thou will. Love is the law, love under will.
what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Law or queen seated in the east underneath. No law beyond, do what thou wilt. Love is the law, love under will. The manifestation of Nuit precedes the great book, holy document, sacred light, handed from the secret chiefs to the beast, prophet of the new aeon, with more power than a seance. Onk off, knock on, sue, the skill of revealing is calling you to your true will, wear your jewels and rich robes and toast, the equinox is on, so raise your chalice and sing along. Do what thou wilt, shall be the whole of the law. Proud war queen seated in the east under Nuit. No law beyond, do what thou wilt. Love is the law, love under will. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Raw or queen seated in the east under Nuit. No law beyond, do what thou wilt. Love is the law, love under will. Was lost, but I was saw. We needed freedom, defeated and feeling cheated in consciousness of sin. The prison we're in, slave god mentality, psychic brutality. The Pharisees of a fallacy propagate the hatred of self sacrifice till there's no self to sacrifice. New era, the word of sin is restriction. Rejoice, be free, exceed, exceed, repeat with me. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Raw or queen seated in the east under me. No law beyond, do what thou wilt. Love is the law, love under will. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Wild war queen seated in the east under Nuit. No law beyond, do what thou wilt. Love is the law, love under will. Brothers and sisters of earth, every man and every woman is a star. Book of the law, lift yourselves up. Put beneath your feet all fears. Let me hear the people cheer. Come forth, be free and joyous. Walk with us in light, life, love, and liberty. By the prophecy of Nuit and Hadid. Wake from the sleep, raw, seated in the east. Eat, drink, work, live, play as you will. Think as you will. Rest, die, move, dwell, speak as you will. Write as you will. Draw, paint, carve, etch, mold, and build as you will. Dress as you will. Overall, love as you will. Love under will. What thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Raw or queen seated in the east under Nuit. No law beyond, do what thou wilt. Love is the law, love under will. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Raw or queen seated in the east under Nuit. No law beyond, do what thou wilt. Love is the law, love under will.
Thanks again to Christian Fitzharris, a.k.a. Scholar, for being on the show and for also sending in that music. I look forward to December when his CD comes out. Next, we have Keith 418 talking about cults and the appearance of being cultic. This stems from some discussion that he and I have seen recently online where a lot of people are saying various things about the Thelemic community and that they don't want to do certain tasks because that would seem to make Thelema cultic, or that because they don't look cultic, it's some kind of consolation prize. So I got into that with Keith, and it's a very interesting conversation. So here it is.
Keith, welcome back to the podcast, 93.
Oh, 93, John. Thanks for having me.
Recently, in some of the online discussions about Thelema and the Thelemic community, there have been numerous references that if the Thelemic community operates in a certain way or takes particular stances towards things, that it would be considered cultic or like a cult, in particular to the OTO. If it told members to do certain things, that it would be like a cult and that this was taken as a bad thing. What are your thoughts about aspects of cultic nature?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question, and I think we need to examine the whole idea of what a cult is and how to define it. I mean, most religious historians and people studying contemporary religions tend to shy away from using the word cult. It's a loaded expression, it has pejorative connotations, and it's very hard to define. Is the Catholic Church a cult? Is the Unification Church a cult? Is Scientology a cult? People tend to use the term cult when they really are talking about authoritative organization or a totalizing one, but it tends to sort of fall down towards marginal, smaller religious groups, and I think it's a pretty poor choice of words. I tend to shy away from using it, and I think, you know, if you look at the writing that we tend to do on these kinds of subjects, we, when we examine it, use terms like sect or church. rather than the word cult.
Right.
But I think the anxiety that people have about the Thelemic community being a cult or cultic groups within the Thelemic community is really interesting, if you'll pardon me using that word. I think it's fascinating to examine why people are so worried about looking like a cult or having a cult sort of nuances or flavors to what they're doing, or avoid the way a cult might look. That to me is worth really looking closely at. So when people say, oh, this is a cult or that's a cult, you know, oftentimes you'll see people in the OTO, for example, making fun of the Scientologists and talk about like some weird Scientology beliefs like Zemu or Xenu blowing people up in volcanoes or traveling around with souls frozen in ice cubes on DC-10s. And, you know, in a way, I think this helps alleviate their anxiety about believing that some disincarnate Arab-looking figure dictated the Book of the Law to Crowley in a hotel room in Cairo in 1904. I mean, if the Scientologists believe in weird things, don't we believe in weird things too? It's just a way to kind of alleviate our anxiety over the strange things that we claim to believe. So I think that's interesting. I also think that the concern people have about cults really comes from their own allegiance, whether they know it or not, to the values of mainstream society, which sees totalizing or authoritative religious groups is inherently threatening. And this, to me, doesn't mean that they're kind of opposed to authority or totalizing experiences. It's just that their allegiances are to other kinds of authorities, the authorities of sport culture, the authorities of the media, the authority of the values that they're taught in school or in college, rather than, you know, they see that the people adhering to these other totalizing strategies are dangerous, but they don't want to look at their own adherence to totalizing ideologies at all. So I think that we need to examine that as well. One of the things that I think is really interesting when it comes to looking at the cult question is that cults actually can do things that the OTO can't do. Cults can set goals, can hold their members accountable, cults can own property. You know, the groups that people tend to complain about as being cultic actually get a lot of stuff done compared to the OTO. The OTO isn't really publishing a lot of books right now, which it used to. You know, the OTO doesn't own any property of note. You know, these are all things that cults can do very well. On the other hand, what people complain about with cults is that there's a culture of fear, there's not a lot of dissent that's encouraged, you know, people are worried about getting booted out, there's all these other, you know, kind of unhappy-making concerns. Well, the OTO has those problems, but it doesn't have any of the good things that these so-called cult groups have. So there seems to me like the worst of both worlds scenario here. We don't have the good things that cults have, and we can't do the good things that they do, but we certainly have a lot of the problems that cults seem to have. So how do we get out of that, and how do we address that? And I think that's significant. The other problem that a friend of mine used to point out to me at my old political job, with any group that actually organizes effectively enough to make significant change in the world is going to be viewed as a cult by people. And he said, you have to just accept that that's going to be the case. And if you're so worried about being a cult, you won't get a lot done. And part of me thinks that the OTO isn't getting a lot done, that the Thelemic community isn't a more powerful force in society because its members are so terrified about being seen as a cult. They don't want to make the same kind of commitments. They don't want to accept the same kinds of authority. The authority that they have doesn't want to make severe demands on people. And consequently, very little gets done. And that trade-off seems acceptable to most of the, you know, middle-class and lower-middle-class members of the organization. And you hear them actually say things like, well, we may not have buildings and we may not be very serious, but at least we're not a cult.
As if that's some kind of consolation prize?
Right. Is that your consolation prize? Is that, does that justify the fact that the group looks so silly and lame in a lot of ways?
Yeah.
So what is that really saying?
So
where are your real allegiances? If you're really worried about being seen as a cult, if you're really worried about cultic influences, where are your real allegiances? And one of the things that I find fascinating is that even people who aren't involved in the OTO but are sort of interested in the occult and kind of like watching the community, when you start talking about making strategic plans, taking the organization seriously, holding people accountable, setting goals, these people get really upset. Their attitude is, you shouldn't be doing that. And I say to them, well, would you have a problem if the Episcopal Church was setting goals? Would you have a problem if a Reformed synagogue was doing strategic planning? Why is it okay for these other groups to take their stuff seriously and have strategic plans and own property and hold people accountable. But why is it not okay for us to do the same thing?
Well, I think the reality is those organizations are closer to normative society's values. So if they end up becoming empowered, all they're going to be doing is pushing an agenda that will further society as it is. Whereas
right, but
Thelema,
using the term cult is a delegitimizing term. It delegitimizes the religious group that's involved. If you say, well, they're a member of a cult, that means that the religious beliefs that those people have are not legitimate.
That's correct.
No one sees the Episcopal Church or Reformed Synagogue as being, you know, not legitimate in the same way.
Right. When people consider Scientology or even Opus Dei as a cult, they're trying to diminish the legitimacy of it and paint them as some kind of non-serious or something that society should exclude or dismiss, not take seriously.
Exactly. And that's how the larger society makes its values predominant, is by excluding and diminishing groups that threaten or challenge it. And, you know, the trade-off seems to be, I can be in the OTO as long as it's not a cult.
Right.
I can be a Thelemite as long as I don't take it seriously enough for it to be dangerous.
Right.
And the more you examine this look about what a cult really is or how a cult might be in Thelema, the more you see people's real anxieties below the surface about what Thelema is and what it really demands of them.
Well, I want to, let's go to that dangerous aspect. What is dangerous about it and why do they see it's dangerous? Where is this idea that cults are dangerous? Where is that coming from?
Well, it's coming from a larger society which doesn't want any threat to its dominion.
Right, and so the hegemony is seeing these other organizations that are vying for power, that are setting themselves up as these apparatuses of attention and empowering to people to be against the normative society, and
right.
So they're seeing the threat here, and they're going, this threat is bad, so we need to delegitimize them so people don't take them seriously.
Right, and it would be one thing if it was just people outside of the OTO who was doing this, but the OTO has so many people inside of it. I think its own leaders participate in this sort of delegitimization of it process. I think they've kind of made an interior decision on some level. The OTO is acceptable and Thelema is acceptable as long as it's not a cult and as long as no one takes it all that seriously, as long as no one makes serious sorts of commitments that would make it look like a cult.
Well, I think this is a problem for the OTO, but I think it's a problem for almost all of esotericism. Anytime you bring up magic or magical practices, all of a sudden, oh, you don't really believe in that kind of stuff, or it has to be couched in some kind of quasi-psychological language that delegitimizes any kind of external manifestation.
Right.
Or you see
the academic approach, and this is what a lot of sort of, you know, middle class and aspiring middle class people in the OTO want to approach it. They want to approach it as psychology. They want to approach it as an academic discipline. I'm not an occultist in that I actually believe in what Crowley taught, but I study it as an academic.
Right. It gives you the trappings
of the secular culture and the approval. Oh, we approve of people studying this stuff. We don't really approve of people believing in it.
Right. Because if they believed it, that would actually be something that is contrary to our secular society.
Right, and potentially dangerous. And what's fascinating to me about this is that we're getting this not from just people outside of the OTO, although a lot of them, I think, are you know, doing it too, but from people within the group itself. I mean, from the leaders of the organization, who you'd expect in normative circumstances to be pushing for more engagement, more involvement, you know, more commitment, more accountability. Those are the very people who are the most anxious about actually creating an organization that would look that way. Because they're the ones often who got into the positions of power because they were the most normative, the most conventionally responsible, the most invested in society's values. And consequently, that's what the conflict and the crisis is.
Right.
So when they reassure themselves that at least they're not a cult, you know, we don't have a lot of money, we don't take it really seriously, we're not publishing the books anymore, we don't own any property, but at least we're not a cult. At least we're not a cult.
So
and the argument is, in order to get any of those things accomplished in a serious, purposeful manner, it would start to look like a cult, and that would freak people out. They wouldn't want to do it anymore.
The OTO has an interesting problem where the members who are most into the material, it seems, are the ones who are the most disaffected from society and can't get anything done. Whereas the ones who are least into the material and more middle class and established within society seem to be able to get things done in an administrative way. They're the ones who rise through the levels to become the administrators of the order, but in doing so, they remove themselves from the material. So what has resulted is this large bureaucratic organization that has lots of efficiency on the administrative level, but has no informing values, no connection to the literature, and just results in some kind of empty formalism.
Well, I think that's one aspect of the empty formalism. I'm not always convinced that the people who are the most invested in the material are unable to function in a larger society. I think that that's sort of a problematic assertion, in that there are people who are very invested in the material who can function very well in society. A lot of those people have given up on trying to make the OTO serious because they're tired of dealing with the people who aren't interested in the material, and I can certainly respect that. I think a lot of the kind of kookier elements in the community, the people who, you know, walk around in magical robes all the time or seem like kind of urban shamans on a certain level, those people I don't really feel are that invested in the material, mostly because I don't think they have the education and background to understand it very well. They're not the people constantly reading the text and studying them and showing us what they mean. They're not the people really committed to the higher practices. What they are is practicing a sort of folk magic, tiered response to the material that, maybe they may be sincere about, but it doesn't really manifest in anything significant, which it would have to if they were really committed to the material.
Well, okay. Here's an interesting problem, or maybe some kind of paradox we have here. To really be able to engage in this material and get the abstract ideas and work with it, you have to be educated. But isn't the current educational system an ideological entrenching environment in which if you go and get an education, they're going to be pushing a very liberal secular humanist agenda, and don't a lot of people succumb to that ideology?
Yeah, that's a huge paradox and a huge crisis that has to be overcome. But the good news about that is that that ideological paradigm, that secular humanism, is inherently nihilistic and is destabilizing itself, doesn't work, and doesn't satisfy people. If it worked and satisfied people, we wouldn't have the OTO at all. But in fact, on many levels, it's not working anymore. It doesn't produce real achievement and accomplishment. It's lame. It's boring. It doesn't excite anyone. It's not challenging. So consequently, the seeds of its own destruction and its own inner logic of nihilism, as Nietzsche and Heidegger would point out, are already self-evident. So, yeah, you do need an education, and yeah, you are going to get indoctrinated, but you're also going to see that that indoctrination is a tremendous failure when it comes to practical real-world issues. It just doesn't work.
But don't you think a lot of the people who are approaching Thelema and occultism from the distance of the academy, or who have gotten the degrees, have bought into the liberal secular humanism and normative society, and that's why they have a lot of the problems they have?
Absolutely, and I hope that those same people will begin to question their training and their indoctrination and begin to see why it's stupid. And that's one of the things that I really feel we need to help them with, is to reveal to them, hey, Crowley hated that, he thought it was stupid, it's not part of his teaching, stop trying to reconcile your liberal secular humanism with Thelema, it's not going to work, and it's only going to result in dysfunctional organizations like the current OTO. In a lot of ways, I think we can look at the current OTO and see it as proof of the failure of exactly that sort of reconciliation attempt. It's just you can't reconcile those two things. So the good news is it's not working. They may be trying it, but it's not working, and it's not very challenging.
So the reason...
Look at some of your listeners, John. The younger people who are really interested in the material, have a lot of energy, really focused on it, they don't find liberal, secular, humanist occultism interesting. They don't find it challenging. They don't want to get involved with it. They reject it out of hand. That's a good sign.
Right, but they don't have the skills to really deeply engage in the material because they're lacking in education.
Right. Well, we're working on helping them with that.
So the whole point is to go to school, get an education, but don't buy the ideology, but get the skills so then you can really engage in the material.
And I think that that's not as difficult as it might seem. It is a paradox, it is a problem, but we expect magicians to address paradoxes and problems and overcome them.
Well, I think that's a good stopping point for this podcast, and I appreciate you being on again, and I'll talk
to you
soon.
Thank you for having me.
93
John.
Thanks again to Keith418 for coming on the show. There's always mixed response to the shows that he's on. Some people love it, and as you get from some of the feedback we've seen, they appreciate the comments and discussions that he and I have. And some people think he comes on the show too much, and others ask when he isn't on the show why he's not. So in the end, he comes on the show frequently because I ask him to, and I like what he brings to it. I think he has some interesting ideas. And in the end, I want to kind of get people thinking, and Keith's comments help people do that. So I will keep having him on the show, and if you don't like it, well, then you can fast forward over that section. Now we're going to move on to the discussion with Gordon Jurjevich. We'll be discussing Indian Tantra and Western esotericism, and the combinations where esotericism seems to overlap with Tantra. Gordon is a lecturer at the University of British Columbia and has been studying occultism for well over a decade. So I think he brings a lot to this subject, and it's quite fascinating. So here is Gordon.
We have on the phone with us Gordon Jurjevich. Are you there, Gordon?
Here, I'm here.
Welcome to the show,
93.
We met a few months ago at the 2006 Esoteric Conference, and you gave a paper called The Great Beast as a Tantric Hero, The Role of Yoga and Tantra in Aleister Crowley's Magic. And I wanted to have you on the program to kind of talk about your paper and the aspects of Crowley and yoga and Tantra. So to start off, can you go over a bit of the connections between Indian Tantra or Indian spirituality and Western esoterics or Western esoteric traditions?
It goes on several levels. First of all, historically, there has always been an interest in India from the side of Western esoteric tradition, and India has always been kind of a magic land of magic and power and fantasy or whatnot. I mean, this is, you're talking about imagination, about imaginary India. That does not necessarily coincide with the actual reality, but nevertheless, the image, the picture, the romantic image of India as a land of mystery and magic has always been part of Western imagination. That's on the one hand. Also, historically speaking, in 1875, when a Theosophical Society was founded in New York City by Helena Blavatsky and Alcott, the goal of the society was to kind of bridge Western and Eastern esoteric tradition, and also this was probably the first time that Indian esotericism and Eastern esotericism came to the West in a sort of an organized manner, I mean, to the degree that it was possible at the time. So, Theosophical Society was, as we all know, hugely popular movement that included thousands and thousands of people, and it did create a certain deep and long-lasting interest in Eastern and Indian spirituality in the West, especially in the Western occult circles. This becomes particularly true and interesting and important with Aleister Crowley and his work, his own exploration of Eastern Indian Chinese. But let's focus for the moment on Indian spirituality. And what I mean by this, that he wrote extensively on this subject. His Mysticism, which was the part one of his magnum opus Magic, dealt with the principles of yoga, theoretical principles of yoga. He published several books of instruction on how to do yogic practices, including posture, asana, including breathing, pranayama, practice of concentration, dharana. He speculated on the nature of meditation, the nature of samadhi, etc. And also, what was very important and interesting is that Crowley incorporated yogic practices, practice of meditation, practice of posture, yogic practice of breathing, into the curriculum of his magical order AA. And as we know, the AA was a Crowley's reinterpretation and reorganization of the Hermetic order of the Golden Dawn, which on its own was the most important 19th century Western magical order. So with the AA being having yoga firmly incorporated into its own initiatic structure, situation becomes interesting because we have an order, a magical fraternity, Western magical order, that to a large degree was based on the historical lines of Western occult groups and secret societies. So it had very definite framework shaped along the guidelines and essential features of Western esoteric tradition. On the other hand, significant amount of work needed, incorporated into the curriculum of the AA, rests on the practices and principles of yoga and meditation. So that's very interesting. In this sense, then we have a fusion of the Western and Eastern esotericism incorporated in a typically Western magical society. So this is on the one hand, and interest in Tantra again has been this Western interest in Tantra was a bit different in its own. Westerners who first encountered Tantric teaching were initially shocked by it, and it took a while before Tantra became a respectable subject for academic study. Important name in this regard was John Woodruff, Arthur Avalon, who published a series of books on Tantra, and on the one hand, his importance was good and great because he attempted and to a large degree succeeded in making it obvious that Tantra is a serious spiritual practice and serious theory and theology. But the problem with Avalon's approach, with John Woodruff's approach, was that he sanitized Tantra. He tried to whitewash it. And again, there are historical reasons why this was needed at the time, why this was the necessary step at the time. However, there are certain problems in his representation, in his approach to Tantra, basically in his presentation of Tantra. Academically speaking, it was probably only after the Second World War, that a serious interest in Tantra and a bit more deep and serious understanding of Tantra was done from the perspective of Western scholarship. And in the last several decades, we have a significant number of interesting and important scholars that are both translating important tantric works and also writing analytical works, speculating on the nature and philosophy of it and similar things. Crowley was here interesting because he was also one of the first Western occult figures who wrote about Tantra, mentioned Tantra relatively often in his writings, and there is this general assumption and understanding that some principles of Tantra are on the one hand deemed by Crowley to be similar or identical or correspondent to Western sexual magic. On the other hand, there is also this general understanding or assumption that the OTO is a Western magical order based on a Freemasonic lines, shelters in some of its higher degrees certain principles of tantric theory and practice. So that's my answer.
All right, well, let's take a step back and go a little back to the yoga.
Sure.
In your paper, you talk a bit about Crowley and his lectures, the 8 lectures in yoga,
uh-huh,
and kind of going into the yogic concept of niyama,
uh-huh,
the discipline or the positive power in Crowley's
uh-huh
exposition. Can you explain where within the magical Western tradition that Crowley was implementing this yoga, where niyama is? Because I think it's an important concept within the yogic practice and a very important complement
uh-huh
to ritual and so forth. Can you touch on niyama?
Well, that is rather interesting subject in a sense that Crowley was here on the one hand very intuitive and very to the point. On the other hand, he was also rather iconoclastic and a bit different from what was expected as far as the issue was concerned. What I mean by this is that in several of his works, for example, in Mysticism and also in some other works, he dismisses Yama and Niyama as the first two preliminary steps of the eighth step or eighth limb yoga, Ashtanga yoga associated with Patanjali or whatnot. These two first steps usually need with the moral preparation of a candidate for yoga. And Crowley was of the opinion that these are of lesser importance and that they have only culture-specific value and that these are not universal yogic values. And essentially, his position was that it is rather difficult to practice yoga if you lead a kind of a life that is detrimental for this practice. So therefore, his philosophy was that one should lead a life that is conducive to the practice of yoga, which means not too much excitement, not too much crazy things, trying to live a simple life, and this will be conducive to your practice of yoga. For this reason, he also, in some of his works, can't quote right now at the moment precisely which work was that, but he essentially explains that yama and niyama can be summarized as the will shall be the whole of the law, meaning live in the accordance with your own nature, and then being such, your mind will not be distracted, it will be harmonized with your basic way of life, and this will be your first preliminary step that will make it possible for you to actually engage in the practice of yoga. So this is one way in which Crowley tried to invoke the principle of cultural relativism when applied to the practice of yoga. In general, and this is especially clear from his eight lectures on yoga, his intention was to strip yoga of its exotic allure, to strip yoga of its exotic fascination, exotic fascinating image, and to show that yoga is a practice of the training of the mind that can be found in pretty much every culture and pretty much every religion, especially mystical traditions of every religion. So since Niyama deals with the positive values that one should cultivate in order to practice yoga, in the eighth lectures on yoga, Crowley did something rather interesting where he tried to draw a correspondence, similarity or analogy between the Western ideas about astrology and the essential principles of Niyama, basically taking the classical planets that astrology deals with and trying to see what would those planets be when applied to human body and mind, and how would those qualities that we associate with Saturn or with Mars or with Jupiter or with Sun, Venus, how would those qualities that we usually associate with the influence of these planets, how could they be conducive to your own practice of yoga? So I think that this is rather interesting and rather innovative, rather original approach to this particular issue, how to set up certain background, certain basic lifestyle that would be in accordance with your own nature and as such would help you to focus your mind on the essential task of yoga. And essential task of yoga in Crowley's interpretation was basically cultivation and concentration of the mind.
Okay. Well, let's move the practice of the yogic practice now forward into the tantric practices.
Okay.
And let's take a look at the Gnostic Mass, which is the public ceremony that Crowley created. And can you talk about some of the Western Gnostic, the Thelemic, and the Hindu Tantric ideas that are embodied in the Mass itself?
Well, this is rather difficult, and what I have tried to accomplish in the paper and in the talk that I gave based on this paper was to offer possible explanation, possible interpretation of the dynamic of the Gnostic Mass in the light of the tantric theories of the value, religious, mystical value and importance of human sexual secretions. And here it is not very I'm speculating here, but my comparison draws on the analogy between the use of, let's say, human sperm and menstrual vaginal blood. And we know from the study of Eastern Tantra, Indian Tantra, that several schools of tantric orientation have assigned mystical and magical value to both men's sperm and female menstrual blood. Importance attached to the value of the semen sometimes is translated into actual practice in the by the insistence on celibacy. And there is a very prominent idea among certain yogic schools, particularly the Nath Siddhas, that one should not waste one's semen, and that to do so leads to old age, disease, and ultimately death, and that instead one should preserve one's sperm. And not only that, there exists very prominent yogic and tantric tradition in which it was assumed that sperm originates in the brain or in the highest chakra within the human body, and that in the process this semen, this sperm, which is while at the top of the head has the quality of the elixir of immortality, it slowly drips down through the spinal column, and then it gets devoured or burned by either digestive fire, or it gets released from the body, which was a negative consequence in the sexual act. For this reason, not only is human semen sperm supposed to be contained within the hermetically sealed yogic body, but also the yogis and tantrics are attempting to establish the return of the semen from the lower position around the genital organs, to establish the rising upward movement of this sperm until it reaches back its origin at the top of the head, and by which process then it again becomes elixir and ambrosia. So there are ways in which this is possible to be done by doing certain muscular contractions, by practicing certain kind of breathing, and also by engaging in a certain style of, in a certain manner of visualization, in which you attempt to make possible the return of the semen, or the bindu, to use the technical term, from the position at the base of genital organs up to the top of the head, to the highest chakra, where it becomes the elixir.
And you're relating that to the Gnostic Mass, as in,
and,
from the priest.
In the
priest.
Gnostic Mass, we see something similar, that ultimately it all culminates in the mingling of the symbolical substances, bread and wine, and then the symbolic registers of bread and wine, cake of light and the wine, would correspond to the sun and moon, male and female, gold and silver, etc., etc. So we have mingling of these substances that is also happening at the high altar, which symbolically represents the top of the head, because the temple in which the Gnostic Mass takes place is symbolically patterned on the structure of the human body, and the altar at which the priestess sits, and at which the mingling of the bread and wine takes place, also would correspond anatomically with the top of the head. So in this instance, we might speak about a parallel between the dynamics and symbolic register of the Gnostic Mass and certain yogic and tantric teachings. By which I'm not necessarily saying that Crowley was at the time of writing Gnostic Mass informed by the tantric teachings, and that he just translated them into the Western ecclesiastic ritual. I'm not saying exactly that, although this is quite possible. My argument is that there is a parallel, that there is a correspondence between these two ideas, practices, and notions.
Anybody who studied Crowley knows that the Gnostic Mass is the symbolic representation of kind of the more deeper or meaningful secrets that are within the OTO higher degrees. So from your research, do you see direct correlations between the information that is available that's taught about the higher degrees in the OTO and tantric practices that are found in the East?
Well, to my understanding, there is a correspondence and there is analogy. The problem is that both tantric text and the OTO text on this subject are written within a symbolic, within a certain symbolic register. They are usually not expressed in an open language, but they use certain symbolic imagery. So for that reason, it is rather difficult to establish parallel on certain terms. However, it seems to me that functional and meaningful parallel does exist.
Can you explain some of the parallels that you see between Tantra and the OTO system that you know of?
Well, at the most obvious level, based on what I have read and based on how I understood what Crowley wrote about the notion and value and importance of the semen or the bindu and its the importance of its mingling with the menstrual blood, these same ideas and practices do exist in India in some schools of Tantra. In some cases, the subject of the tantric theory and practice is a solitary practitioner, where all of this is transposed onto a bit more meditational and symbolical level. And also, we do know that there are instances and cases where the actual sexual union between male and female practitioner takes place. We also know, especially, and this is especially true of the bowels of Bengal, which is a syncretic movement that incorporates elements of both Hindu and Muslim mysticism, that they place especially high value on the menstrual blood. In fact, according to their understanding, according to their system, it is the woman that is the carrier of the elixir of immortality, and men can access it only by having intercourse with a woman, or by ingesting and consuming orally the menstrual blood, within which there is this carrier of the immortality and also of gnosis. So this is, on the one hand, that just at the level of physical practice, or at the level of corporal practice, while we are speaking about actual physiology, about actual substances, that there is a certain similarity, certain deep similarity between what Crowley and what you thought about these things and what we found in some tantric teachings. But in addition to this, perhaps even more important is that both Kali and tantric teachings that deal with sexuality, and by the way, tantric teachings do not deal only with sexuality, so sexuality is only an aspect of tantric teachings, but to the degree that they do speak and they do take notice of sexuality, in both Kali and Tantra there is this understanding that the power of sexuality is transformative power, that it is able to produce a certain kind of ecstasy that does start from the bodily experience and does take into account the bodily experience, but the flower of that experience is the spiritual insight, spiritual experience, and that is the perhaps the most important aspect of that all.
Well, in your paper, you go from talking about the tantric aspects in particular,
uh-huh.
and then you start going into the Shethalu period, and talk about Crowley actually kind of putting some of these tantric elements of practice into the praxis of the group. Can you touch a little bit on that, some of the things that were done within the group, and some of the results that he obtained?
Well, again, this is largely my own interpretation. It is not very often that Crowley would use tantric vocabulary when talking about these experiences, except that he very often uses technical vocabulary related to most often he uses the term bindu for the semen, which is kind of typical tantric term for the semen, and occasionally also he would use occasional Hindu words or Sanskrit words for certain experiences such as samadhi or whatnot. But my understanding was that although it is highly disputable whether Crowley was consciously trying to implement some tantric teachings during the Shethalu period, however, in my understanding, in my interpretation, it seems to me that there is a very clear parallel in what he and the group around him were trying to attempt at the Shethalu, and certain deep and important and meaningful aspects of tantric teaching in general. And here, I mean, in both instances, transgressive nature of the tantric teachings and the transgressive nature of some aspects of Crowley's teaching and practice.
What do you mean the transgressive nature?
Yeah, well, that is kind of rather interesting and an important aspect of this all. When I use this term transgressive, then I am kind of invoking a certain binary opposition between the ordinary life and the life that is typical of mystical or spiritual or initiatic aspects of life, understanding of reality, and the value of transgression in religion, in mysticism, is usually such that it is able, transgression is able to shatter the image, whether self-image or image of reality, understanding of the world, to shatter it in such a way that the new and broader and deeper understanding of both self and the reality is possible. So here the assumption is that the ordinary life, Crowley and tantrics would often, while talking about ordinary life, talk about life of non-initiates or people who are not initiates, not necessarily in a technical sense, but in a bit more meaningful and spiritual sense. So there is this dichotomy between the life of an ordinary Joe, or in tantric teaching, ordinary person is usually called pashu, which just means animal or a beast. And life of such ordinary person is usually, I mean, no, I'm not being very clear. We all have a tendency to form definite image and understanding of both ourselves and the world that surrounds us. We do have a certain image of reality that is comforting and that is functional in our everyday life. However, we all know from our own experiences that ultimate reality transcends this picture, convenient and conventional understanding of both self and the other. And sometimes it is possible to transcend this ordinary and limiting image and understanding. Sometimes it is possible to transcend it through meditation, through teaching, but sometimes a bit more harsh approach is necessary or needed, or at least certain teachings or certain teachers advocate such practices. I think that to a certain degree, such experience is also alluded in the tarot card number 16, the Tower or the Blessed Tower, where the old self, the old image, the old understanding of the world is shattered. And this is potentially good experience because it allows breaking of the boundaries and the incorporation of a larger vision. So transgressive teachings, those that go beyond everyday and conventional morality and way of life, can be conducive to achievement of this broader vision. This is also a bit tricky, a bit dangerous path, but this is also very typical for Tantra, because both Hindu and Buddhist Tantra very often defines itself as a dangerous path. It is a quick path toward spiritual maturity and knowledge and wisdom, but it's also a potentially dangerous path because it deals with strong teachings and ideas and practices. And it seems to me that this is in general visible from Crowley's lifestyle. In his diaries, he once wrote that his nature is such that he's able to provoke spiritual crisis in persons around him.
Mm-hmm.
So this provoking of the spiritual crisis in his disciples, in his friends, and it's an interesting aspect of his personality, an interesting aspect of his manner of teaching, and also invocation of spiritual crisis is a method that is used in many other mystical, magical, occult, and religious teachings. So I was trying to speculate on this aspect, keeping in mind certain ideas, certain practices, certain aspects of tantric teachings. For example, we know this is rather well known of tantric practices, that they very often invoke meditating on a cremation ground, something meditating while sitting on a corpse, doing certain rituals in a scary environment. They also, we know from the literature that occasionally or often, depending on the case, tantrics would use transgressive sexual practices involving incest, involving ritual sex between castes, between different castes, which in India is rather transgressive practice. Sometimes having sex with an extremely ugly partner. We know that in the Western magical tradition, Austin Spear was very often took advantage of this system, having sex with rather old and ugly partners, as a method of transgressing your usual approach to an understanding of sexuality and things like that.
From your research, does it seem to you that Crowley was using the tantric sexual practices to be transgressive, to challenge the norms and mores of the Victorian world in which he grew up, that he was trying to not only push himself but push others to get kind of to transcend their particular morality and kind of challenge their highest moral values?
I am pretty certain that that's what Crowley did. Whether he was influenced by Tantra in doing so, it's a question that can be debated. However, I think that Crowley's knowledge and understanding and acquaintance with aspects of Tantra was an important aspect of his unconventional lifestyle and his attempt to transgress the morality of his time and of his culture. However, there were also other elements that were important for Crowley in this respect. On the one hand, he mostly can be defined by as a decadent, and the decadence as an artistic movement is again rather interesting, and it's a subject in itself, but what connects decadence with, let's say, Tantra is again this aspect of transgression, breaking the bounds of conventional morality, conventional self-understanding, and the like. In addition to this, I also believe that Crowley was consciously trying to go beyond what was considered usual, ordinary, acceptable by his time and by his culture, because he was led by the role assigned to him in the Book of the Law, where he was assigned to be the prophet of the new age, of the new eon. A new eon brings new scale of values, new scale of virtues, and so I think that in this case the answer is rather complex, that there have been several factors converging, but that I would say that at least in some important aspects of this attempt to transgress the boundaries of Victorian morality, that there is a strong parallel with Tantric teachings that also typically try to transgress the boundaries and norms of the Indian Brahminical everyday society and assumptions.
Earlier you were talking about the transference of the bindu from the base of the spine, like at the Muladhara chakra, and moving it up. You haven't really talked much about the Kundalini aspects of Tantra and its relationship in Crowley's system. Can you touch a little on the Kundalini energy and its role within this process?
Yes, and this is an aspect of Crowley's teaching and practice which I did not go into in my paper at all, and this is a serious shortcoming of my paper, one of the limitations of it. Crowley never, as far as I'm concerned, he does not have a particular text, book, chapter, essay that would deal specifically with this issue. However, throughout his writing, in his diaries and in his many other writings, he makes constant references to Kundalini as the essential magical force in human being, and it can be speculated that his understanding was that the magician needs to develop, to wake up, and to cultivate this energy of Kundalini, and that it is the essential magical force in the human body. And here, of course, again, there is a very, very strong parallel with the Tantric system, because they also assign primary importance to the waking up and cultivation of this energy. Sometimes this is done in using different vocabulary. For example, not always tantrics talk about Kundalini. Sometimes they use other descriptions. However, the import of the message is always one and the same, that it is possible to wake up certain occult force within the human body, and that doing certain practices is very conducive to this. These practices can sometimes involve celibacy, sometimes can involve sex, sometimes can involve taking of various drugs, other practices. However, the assumption is that this force, once it has been awakened within the human body, it is able to bring about the dawn of gnosis and this is an essential task, essential practice of both magic as it was envisioned by Crowley and of the tantric practice as it was talked about and practiced in Indian yoga and tantra. So again, here there is a very, very strong parallel between Crowley and tantrics.
So do you see as the process of yogic practice as the process of awakening and channeling and using this kundalini energy?
Well, here the answer is both yes and no. We can, for the purpose of analytical description, say that yoga can be defined as a method of cultivating focus of the mind, and that tantra perhaps can be defined as an attempt to wake up kundalini and chakras within the human body, and it brings about gnosis or immortality or whatever. But when we talk about these things in such analytical way, there is a perhaps possibility of misunderstanding that yoga and tantra are two separate disciplines, while in fact they inform each other and they are mutually conducive to success in each. So the answer is yes.
Okay. Is there anything else that you want to add to this kind of discussion to get into people's minds to be thinking about this through Crowley's work?
Well, perhaps only I mean, of course, my understanding is that we do not have clear understanding either of Crowley or of Tantra, and there is a lot of misunderstanding of both of them. What is usually misunderstood about Tantra in the West is that Tantra is mostly and only about sex. Here the answer is really much more complex. The reality is much more complex, and there are certain schools, certain groups among tantrics that focus on sexuality. There are also tantric groups that do not include any sexuality of all. I mean sexuality in an ordinary way, meaning people having actual physical sex. However, so this is on the one hand, and so deeper understanding, much broader understanding of Tantra and of Crowley would be conducive to better understanding of both of them. I would say that what also strongly connects both Western esoteric tradition and Indian yoga and Tantra is that we can conceptualize both of these as, in fact, very similar esoteric traditions, and that they are based on the occult properties of human body and mind. And this is something that really needs to be investigated, thought about, speculated about, and of course practiced. So that'll be it.
All right. Well, thank you for being on the podcast and talking about your paper. I know this is an enormous subject and we only have a small amount of time, but I wanted to at least get a little information out there to get the listeners thinking about this and so
forth. Well, thank you.
So thanks for being on the show, 93.
I want to thank all of my guests for being on the show. Christian, Keith, and Gordon, you've really brought a broad selection of ideas that are affecting occultism today. And that's kind of the goal of the podcast, to look at how Thelema and occultism, esotericism, Crowley, and all of these subjects are manifesting in the world today. So really appreciate you taking the time. The outgoing song is from Christian Fitzharris. It is called Nepotastic True. This is a song he wrote that kind of looks at the subject of nepotism and advancement by people who don't necessarily earn their advancement through work. Nepotism usually has the connotation of being with just family members, but I think he broadens the term to those who gain position by either membership of a family or by just the old buddy-buddy system, the old, getting advanced by having friends in high places. It's not what you know or what you do, it's who you know. So that's what his song is about, and I think it's very apt to some of the discussion that takes place here on the podcast. So until the next podcast, thanks for listening, and I hope to hear back from you soon, especially via voicemail, 206-600-4216. Love is the law. Love under will.
Scholar, star 156, this song is dedicated to all oblivious, incompetent people. Got where they are by knowing people in high places without doing the work to deserve their position. It's a fact of life that the incompetent get promoted and the average soldier gets demoted or overlooked. Don't sleep in the right bed, don't serve as the right head. You might find your career winding up dead. It's an unfortunate and sad state. The complacency that breeds leaders to be deceived by their kin or the people they thought capable of managing many duties. It's truly unusual to see level-headed, intelligent men and women in position to cause good. More like a nepotistic infection like rotted wood, causing many to question whether or not they should swallow it or stand up, risking their own all alone, like sitting on their own throne. It could be of gold or an electric chair of death, while the rest invest in the best lie of all time. Nepotism is not a crime, and yet I climb. Do I know you? No. Maybe you're not ready to go past this point. Who do you know that would make me believe you're ready to proceed? Are you on my team? Do I know you? No. Maybe you're not ready to go past this point. Who do you know that would make me believe you're ready to proceed? Are you on my team? Like teachers with tenure, protected with impunity. I've seen the strong given a plaque to hang in the back, while the weak get packed, filling their sacks to the max. Even people not in the know something's wrong. Not long before questions are dodged and doubt is lodged in the brain of the innocent. You can only hold close to an emperor with no clothes for so long, until you're unclothing yourself, exposing your intentions whether or not to sell out and gain clout in exchange for integrity and anonymity. My enemies are the ones given without achieving. I work and work to build, but motivation is killed if you give people who talk loud without result pounds of praise, flying their name into fame, while people like me struggle to save face. We get replaced by known cronies without haste. Do I know you? No. Maybe you're not ready to go past this point. Who do you know that would make me believe you're ready to proceed? Are you on my team? Do I know you? No. Maybe you're not ready to go past this point. Who do you know that would make me believe you're ready to proceed? Are you on my team? Maybe the problem is not in the pudding, but in the people making the pudding. Maybe the leadership is wrong, and maybe a person put in charge is a follower and not a leader at all. That's why progress crawls and doesn't leap to achieve even the smallest means. Impotent units plant no seeds, they just bleed, and even their blood is dead because they were fed upon the lie that said that we're the best. Amongst the sterile cold clones, founders moan upon their lineage, handed to the grasp of an ass with mass vernacular. Spectacular when it comes to fruitless acts, knowledge without facts, titles without tasks. I ask, is it possible to put actual work first? Those who would earn first, opposed to those immersed in egotism and dropping them like a prism, given no criticism on account of this nepotism. Do I know you? No. Maybe you're not ready to go past this point. Who do you know that would make me believe you're ready to proceed? Are you on my team? Do I know you? No. Maybe you're not ready to go past this point. Who do you know that would make me believe you're ready to proceed? Are you on my team? Do I know you? No. Maybe you're not. So there you go.